For those that you don't know me, my name's Jackie, and I'm a friend of Tim and Jessica's in this church, and I'm very pleased to be here today to be able to speak. Two things I want to say before I start, or I'll be terribly self-conscious. One is, I was with my sister the other night, and I dropped the trunk of her car on my forehead. And it's all bruised, and it's all healing. I put makeup on it, but if you see a bruise on my forehead, I don't want to just be staring at it. I tried to cover it with makeup. And the second thing is, this is a result of Tim and myself having discussions about how we can help people really learn how to grow and what it means to have emotional health and healing. And that's what this has come out of. So it might not be a typical sermon on a Sunday morning, but hey, we'll make it work. But what I want to talk about today is, why is it that Christians don't grow? Anyone, for that matter. But since we're in a body of believers here today, why is it that Christians don't grow? Well, there are a number of reasons, I think, that I can't list them all, or it'd be too long, but we want instant maturity. We accepted Christ. Old things passed away. Behold, new things have come. That should just happen, right? Right away. We should be instantly mature. Or we get caught up in a life of busyness, what they call the barrenness of busyness. We move away from our fellowship, and we move into isolation, into being more alone. But that doesn't work, because we're wounded in relationships, and we're going to be healed in relationships. You know, something happened in Genesis chapter 3. Theologians argue about exactly what that was. But in the first two chapters, we see that everything was good. It was very, very good. But something happened. But in that goodness, the man and the woman were naked and unashamed, because they were in communion with God and with each other and with themselves. The principle there is that there's no shame. There's no shame in communion. But they withdrew from that communion with God for whatever reason, and that, I believe, is the DNA of sin. When we withdraw from communion with God, and they moved into isolation, and then what did? They hid. And when they saw their nakedness, they had to hide. When they withdrew from God, their nakedness didn't make any sense to them, and neither does ours. When we live in isolation, nothing has any meaning. I don't know if you've experienced that, but when you live in isolation, nothing has any meaning. And then we end up like this quote that Gail Woodford showed me the other day. She was at my house, and we looked at this. She said this was a gal that was at the start of the new George Clooney movie, and she said this, Sylvia Plath, "It's a hell of a responsibility to be yourself. It's much easier to be somebody else or nobody at all." Well, hopefully we'll have some ways to not necessarily live there. But what I really want to talk about today is the one thing that is probably in my wheelhouse of knowledge, and that's the biggest reason I think we don't grow, is that we fail to negotiate four basic life tasks. And the first one I want to talk about, well, I'll come to that in a minute, but God has passed on to us four aspects of his personality that greatly influence our psychological functioning. I believe that's true. And the first is the ability to bond or to attach. That's the ability of a person to establish an emotional attachment to another person. And I believe this is the most important aspect of spiritual life. It's the basis for repairing our separation and our isolation. Look at Colossians 3:14. Put on love. It's a perfect bond of unity. Ephesians 3:17. We're to be rooted and grounded in love. 1 John 4:16. God is love. The soul can't prosper without emotional connectedness to God, to others, and to ourselves. We're to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, and mind, and love our neighbor as we love ourselves. I believe we're doomed to a lifetime of depression unless this isolation can be ended. Relationship is the most spiritual activity we can engage in. Look at Luke 10:42, the story of Mary and Martha. And what did Jesus say? Mary has chosen the better thing. In our broken or wounded state, whatever we want to say happened in Genesis 3, we're not born into an emotional and spiritual connection. It has to be gained through a difficult developmental process. If you look at an infant, they're in a very cozy, cushy place, hooked to the mom, no separation, and then they're popped into the world and they cry and it's scary, and then they're put on the mom's chest and it's like the baby can go and that bonding relieves the child's sense of separation. That's why I think it's so important and that the scriptures are so clear about the importance of the family and good parenting. If we learn to attach, to trust, we develop. If the process is impaired, we become symptomatic. Over and over again, if we feel loved, even in the absence of the loved one, we can feel their presence. That's called object constancy. I'm giving you a little bit of psychology right in there. But the key to attachment, though, is vulnerability. And that's very hard, especially if we've been hurt. Experiencing one's needs for another. The error that I heard early in my Christian life was, we don't need anything but Jesus. Well, that is really wrong. That's really wrong teaching. We need each other. We can't do it by ourselves. We need God. We need each other. We just can't do it alone. What are some of the symptoms of our inability to be bonded? Things like depression or emptiness or excessive caretaking or loss of meaning, shallow relationships, a sense of panic. If we don't relieve that isolation, it eventually moves to depression and despair. And if we don't relieve that, we end up detached. Nothing really matters one way or the other. And then we really are in emotional pain deep down. What causes this is injury. You know, we enter the world needy. It's just a fact. We're totally dependent. We're not full of love. It has to be given to us. We love because he first loved us. And a parent loves a child, and the child responds back. The child loves back. And it has to be given. If we're hurt, if we're abused, if we're neglected, if our ability to trust gets hindered, and we actually develop a roadmap in our brains and in our feelings, in the cells of our bodies, that all the neuroscientists will tell you that tells you whether relationships are safe or not. And our view of relationships gets formed within us way before we have the ability to reason. That's how important it is. How many people have ever said, I know it in my head, I can't feel it in my heart? That's one of those things. We can know it, but we don't necessarily have it deep in our hearts. We must return to a vulnerable place if we're going to heal the wound that comes from not necessarily being bonded, attached the way we should. This kind of injury can lead us to distortions in our thinking. Things like this: no one's trustworthy. People will always leave me. I'm bad. I'm fundamentally unlovable. God doesn't care about the way I feel. I don't think any of you have ever had thoughts like that. And then if that goes on too long, we build up defenses. We deny our need for others. Or we devalue the available love that's there for us because it may not be what we thought we needed when we were young. We become overly independent to cover our dependency and our neediness, or we project our needs onto others, and then we become really great caretakers of the world. But how do we move from that more towards a bonded state or an attached state? And I can't go into great detail on this, but we need to look at the nature of our past bonding and be honest about it. What was it? What wasn't it? Realize our need to be attached and bonded to the people that we love. Move towards others and be vulnerable. And that's the hardest thing when we've been hurt. Recognize our defenses and begin slowly to work our way out of those defenses so that we don't end up hurting ourselves even more. And the second developmental thing that, or maybe developmental or life task that we fail to negotiate is that of having boundaries. Now, how many of you have heard of boundaries? A lot. Ever since Henry Cloud wrote his book, Boundaries, in the 1990s, it's become a big deal. By the way, a lot of this material is from his book, Changes at Heal, by Henry Cloud. and it's an excellent book if you've never read it. Having boundaries means realizing one's own person apart from others and knowing one's own limits. The issue of separateness forms a basis for our identity, and it rests upon our choices. It's the function of God's likeness in us that says what we are and what we're not, what we will choose and what we won't choose, what one will endure and what we won't endure, what we feel and what we don't feel, all of that. Boundaries define us like a property line defines us. God exercises his will and asks us to do the same. Look at Joshua. God said, Joshua, choose for. But then in Matthew, Jesus says, I want you to choose against. He tells us that we are to confront evil with good and put a limit on the evil that others do to us. Many struggle with their ability to discover and keep personal boundaries, and because of that, they suffer from a lack of purpose or powerlessness, or they have a sense of panic, or they struggle with their own identity, and then that can block our intimacy. And so people ask me a lot, well, what is in my boundaries? What is my responsibility? And this is a hard one, because no matter how these things got in you in the first place, unfortunately, it's now your responsibility to do what you need to do to change it. And that angered me when I was in therapy. I was so mad about that. I didn't have a choice for it happening to me, and now I have to be responsible for my response. I did. Our attitudes, our feelings. To disown your own feelings, not to take responsibility for them, is one of the most destructive things that we can do to ourselves and to others. Psalm 51:6, God desires truth in our innermost being where our feelings lie. He commands us to be honest about those things. Our feelings, I really believe, are the most important aspect of our likeness of God. They move us towards righteousness and towards compassion. They're the basis for empathy. They produce joy. They alert us when something is wrong and when something needs changing. And then the other thing that's within our boundary are our behaviors. Galatians 6, 7, and 8, that we reap what we sow. We are responsible for our own behaviors, our choices, our thoughts, our bodies, our abilities, our wants, our desires, our limits. Those are all within our boundaries, and we are responsible for them. And if we look at how this all came about, when we were first attached, we have to be attached before we can be separate. You see a baby just totally attached, and then you'll notice when they start to separate. No, no, no. That's what you hear the kid. That's the first words most kids learn besides dad or mama is no. And they start to separate. They start to move towards a position of separateness. A person that hasn't been or has boundary problems, there's kind of two kinds of boundary problems. A person who has no boundaries, and those are people that let everyone else control them. They don't have opinions, they don't have thoughts. Where do you want to go to dinner? I don't know, you choose. You know, that's a person that doesn't really have boundaries. Well, maybe what you have for dinner is not that important. But a person that extends their boundaries would be a person that wants to control others or take things that aren't theirs, kind of like if you want to take a country that doesn't belong to you, something like that. Sorry. Didn't mean to say that. The symptoms of not having boundaries is you can't say no. You feel depressed, panic, resentment. Passive aggressive is a big one for someone that doesn't have boundaries. Identity confusion, blaming others, feelings of obligation or a victim mentality. All of those can be signs of not having very good boundaries. Barriers to creating boundary, again, they're injuries. When we grow up, if we're not allowed to own our bodies, our feelings, our choices, is that ringing? Do I bring this with me?
There you go.
Thanks, Tim. You're so helpful. But if we're not allowed to own our bodies, our thoughts, our feelings as we're growing up, our boundaries, if they're disregarded or there's abuse or control or manipulation or we're not allowed to grow, we can't set boundaries as adults or very That's okay. I'll figure it out. And we get injured all the more. If we can't set boundaries, we will be injured all the more. And then we develop thinking errors, distortions. They'll hate me if I say no. People will leave me if I have boundaries. Others are responsible for me. Or people are unloving if they say no to me. Or I must have everything I want. My wants aren't important. Or my God, if God says no to me, he doesn't really care about me. Those are all distorted thinking that we get. But some of the skills that we can begin to develop, and by the way, we negotiate these four life phases, even though they happen between the ages of when we're born till about the end of our 20s, we renegotiate those the rest of our life. We go back, we rework them. But some of the skills is gain awareness. Where do I have boundaries and where don't I have boundaries? Where can I learn to say no? Where can I learn to ask for help when I need it? Those kinds of things. Define ourselves. Begin to figure out, who am I? What do I really think? What do I really believe? Develop our no muscle. Learn to say no. Refuse to play the victim and choose your values and your beliefs. Don't let other people choose those for you. You figure out what they are. And then the next one, which I think is a really difficult one, a developmental task or a life task that we have a difficult time resolving, is resolving that good, bad, all or nothing splitting that's easy to do. It's appropriate for teenagers to do this. That's their developmental phase. They haven't learned yet that, you know, not everything's all or nothing or black or white, and they're struggling with their values and who they are. But we're supposed to grow through that and out of it. But resolving the good and bad is handling the coexistence of good and evil. Ever since Genesis 3 happened, we find good and evil in everything. How do we resolve it? Well, the natural tendency, what I used to want to do, is I wanted to keep the good and the bad separate. I wanted to keep those two things separate. I don't want to admit the bad, that kind of thing. But if we do that, it brings about an intolerance of the badness and the weakness and the failure. And we think, if I'm all good, I'm successful. And if I'm bad, I'm really all bad when I fail. And that's so unrealistic, because we live in a world where there's both success and failure, and there's grayness, and there's not all black and white. So we need to bring those two things back together again. The major reason many Christians struggle is the emotional tone that's in the home and oftentimes in the church, and that's the one of judgment. Judgment is an example of not resolving this developmental phase. We judge ourselves, and then we can't help but we judge others, people that are different than us, those people over there. And we project our bad out there, and then they're the bad, and then we don't have to own any of that bad. Judgment leads to hiding. Love and acceptance leads to transformation. And that's what we want, is transformation. Look at Romans 7. Wretched man that I am, who will set me free from this body of death? What I don't want to do, I do, and what I do, I don't want to do. That's what Paul is really lamenting about. The answer to that is Romans 8:1. There is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And then it goes on to say, for what the law couldn't do, it couldn't. God knew that. He did. He sent his son in the likeness of sin. So it's not that this surprises God at all. It just surprises us, I think. The Bible tends to have many themes, but two that I want to mention is that people are incredible and people are valuable. That's the ideal. But it also has the theme that we sin and we're broken and we hurt others. And that's the real. But both of those are true. And the ways we tend to cope with this splitting stuff is we deny the truth, the less than perfect, the bad, and then we feel all bad. Or we feel pretty good about ourselves, excuse me. Or no, we feel all bad, I'm sorry. But then we deny the good in us, and then we feel like we're bad. Okay, you get that, what I'm trying to say? Oh, well, I get it. And then we attack and we judge the true. And that's sad, because the true is each of us has good and bad in us, and everybody you know has good and bad in them. The key to resolving this is acceptance. We need to experience grace so that we can accept the bad without rejecting the relationship. Developmentally, if a child is condemned for their bad, less than perfect self or their mistakes, they develop a horrible sense inside of shame and guilt, and it follows them the rest of their life. If they're loved and accepted, when they do something wrong, they feel sorrow for themselves that, oh man, that wasn't very kind of me, and sorrow for someone else, for someone they might have hurt. It's a whole different story than feeling guilt and shame. The way out is forgiveness. In this, we are to accept and love in spite of our failures. Forgiving relationships in a body of Christ, like this family that we've been developing here, and Tim and you guys have all developed over the years, this kind of a family can help resolve that good and that bad split. When we are in a family like this where we help each other, we walk with each other, and yet we blow it at times and we come back and we help each other and do it again, that's how we heal. That's how we find out that there can be good and bad in everything, but love wins in the end. And confession is a big part of this. James 5:16. Confess our faults to one another and thus be healed. But we have to find safe, trustworthy people to do that, not just anybody. So we have, it can be a counselor, it can be a therapist, it can be someone here in church, but you want someone that's confidential and that can hold your deepest, most painful parts. If we confess to God and others and we feel no condemnation, we begin to integrate our good and our bad. We can live with it. When we do something wrong, we can feel like, oh man, that wasn't my best moment. But we don't go into shame and guilt and all of those things. If we hide those parts of us, they go into darkness and they take on a life of their own, and I guarantee you they're going to come out somewhere in your life or in your relationships. What are some of the symptoms of not resolving this? Perfectionism, an inability to tolerate painful feelings, inability to tolerate weakness, inability to tolerate black and white, grayness, you want everything to be just this way or just this way, those kinds of things. Guilt, rage is a big one in this stage, and feeling all good or all bad. And then the distortions we develop in our mind are things like, I'm not worth loving, my badness is worse than your badness. They'll leave me if they know. I can only be respected if my Christian walk is perfect. God can't understand my struggles. All of those are thoughts when we get into this black or white, all or nothing, splitting kind of stage. But some of the skills to pull us out of that are confessing to one another, receiving forgiveness, giving forgiveness, expecting good and bad in everyone you know, becoming aware of your own good and bad parts. All of that's important to growing and to bringing together, again, the extremes that we go, all or nothing. And then finally, establishing authority over one's life as an adult is the last stage. And I have to say that most people in life haven't truly done this yet. I know that, I thought I had until a few years ago when I discovered that I was reading a book and I was disappointed that someone didn't measure up to my standards in the book. And I realized I wanted someone that was still above me, someone that I could look to, someone like an invisible parent figure or something, and I had to go, oh darn, I'm still looking to someone else as that authority above me. But we can have done the first three things, and we still can be in a one-up, one-down position in relationship to other people. So the last half is establishing equality with other adults. We start at as little people in a big person's world, and it's a growing up process, and it takes time. 1 Corinthians 13, when I was a child, I thought as a child, reasoned as a child. When I became a man, I did away with those things. So taking authority over oneself as an adult involves responsibility for making your own decisions, having opinions, establishing values that are not subject to the approval of parents or authority figures, responsible for incurring the legal consequences of your actions. You don't need permission to think, feel, or act from an authority figure. Matthew 23, 8 through 10, Jesus called for adults to assume a position of equality with one another. And in Matthew 23, 2 through 4, we're not to consider others above us, but we're called to equality. Coming out from the authority of parents and authority figures and establishing God as our authority is what this whole situation is about, this last one. People who believe others are above them as people are still relating from a child's position of being under a person and not under God. So becoming adults moves us from a rules-based way of thinking to a loved-based way of thinking. Two things in the New Testament, coming out from under the authority of our parents and our parental structures, going towards our allegiance to God. Shift our thinking from rules to principles based on love. You know, rigid and pharisaical people who can't handle ambiguity hate this teaching. And it's because they can't control you. If they don't have a rule, they're going to invent one. Pharisees' theology wasn't big enough to allow for the need of the people. A theology that will not allow people to help someone who is hurting is not big enough to hold the love of God. Symptoms of this is an inordinate need for approval, black and white thinking, hate for authority figures, idealization of authority, and I could go on, anxiety attacks and other things. Some of the skills we need to develop are things like reevaluating our beliefs, making your beliefs your own, disagreeing with authority figures. View your parents and authority figures realistically. They're just people. They're just people. Love different kinds of people. Appreciate mystery. Submit to others out of freedom. Now, in closing, I just want to see that ever since the fall, there have been three things necessary for the healing of human nature. And I'm just going to go super quickly through these. Grace, truth, and time. Grace is love expressing itself to us, not as an idea, but as a real relationship of favor. Grace invites us out of isolation and into relationship. And then truth, we need direction. We need to know what's right and wrong. We need to, you know, grace without truth is going to lead to license, but truth without grace leads to judgment. What's interesting is before Genesis 3, grace and truth appeared to be like this. And then Genesis 3 happened and they were split apart. But what does it say in John 1, 14, and then 16 and 17? The law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came together in Jesus Christ. Isn't that neat? They came together in Jesus Christ. Grace with truth invites the true self into relationship, sometimes for the very first time. And then we give it time. There's no instant growth, folks. It takes time. One of our biggest temptations is we want it to go quickly. But there's no shortcut. We're susceptible to that, but there's no shortcut. For instance, promiscuity is simply a shortcut because it's so much easier to be promiscuous than to do the difficult work of emotional intimacy. So we want to be careful of that. And so what I'm going to do is close here with a couple of quotes. But first of all in all, we need to let grace draw us out of isolation, into relationship, and be honest about what is true inside of us. And we need to let love, and we need to let time take its time, begin to cause us to grow. So all in all, let grace draw us out of isolation, into honest work. And in closing, I just want to show I was preparing for this. The first one is from The Cloud of the Unknown, done in the Middle Ages. It is not what you are or what you have been that God looks at with his merciful eyes, but what you desire to be. Isn't that powerful? And then the last one is Henry David Thoreau. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, and not when I die, discover that I had not lived. So our job is to go out and live. Thank you.
If you're physically able, could you stand with me? I want to lead us in a prayer in response to Jackie's message. And by the way, that message will be online today because that's like a lot to chew on. So you can go over it again and again. But I wanted to tell you that in the Old Testament, God's name wasn't spoken as much as it was inhaled and exhaled. And so you breathed in God and you exhaled God. That was the picture. And it reminded us that we're as close to God as our next breath and that God is also inside of us. So right now, could you close your eyes with me and just think about your own life and take a deep breath right now. Breathe in and breathe out. God, thank you for your presence that's so close to us and that's in us, Lord, that's percolating inside of us. We pray for growth, Lord, and that it's a tough thing. It takes a lot of time and a lot of hard work. Please give us the courage to be vulnerable, and please give us wisdom, Lord, and please give us your strength, and by your grace, can you lead us into growth so we can become the people you designed us to be, and so we can have more experiences with you. Thank you so much, Lord, for this. In your name we pray. Everyone said?